S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, by my baby!
Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba!
Let me in!
Shiba Shiba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shiba Shiba!
Open up your soul!
Shiba Shiba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. There are so many things happening in this world, and we need people who are constantly learning and figuring things out and then being willing to talk about them in a way that helps us make sense of it. So it's Scintillating Science Monday, and I'd like to welcome my scintillating scientist du jour, Teddy Wuerlich. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on the show. Before we get into the science of what you do, what I want to really talk about at the beginning is, when did you get bitten by the science or the computer bug?
Oh, gosh. I think for me, it started not so much with computer science.
Mm-hmm.
But back when I was a kid, I lived in New York, and my younger brother and I would be playing outside all the time. Mm-hmm. We'd be mucking around and catching frogs, and that brought a lot of curiosity for me.
Mm-hmm.
To understand why things work the way they do. And then my family moved out to the Bay Area in California.
Uh-huh.
And I was just exposed from all sides to the tech and the computer science and the hype, which I think was a huge influencing factor in me exploring computer science more. Like, my high school had AP computer science classes, mm-hmm. which was not something my New York high school would have had for me. And I think it was that early exposure that really made me interested. Before college, which was a big deal.
So when you were in high school, were you doing lots of computer, were you building things, or what were you doing? And then what were your parents like? Yay, she's staying out of trouble.
Yeah, my parents were definitely happy that I was looking down the career of a software engineer, because that was, you know, like a very stable job. Like, my parents, my mom was an English teacher, my dad's a physicist,
mm-hmm.
and I think for them, they saw that as professions they really loved, but weren't always the most secure, and so they were always encouraging me to find something I liked, but also find something that had some sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yes, they were quite happy. But in terms of what I was actually up to, I just found it so empowering to be able to code little tools up that I would use in my day-to-day life.
Like what?
And make things easier for myself.
Like what?
So on my, for instance, my speech and debate team, I was in charge of organizing a tournament at some point for
okay.
my class.
Okay.
And we had a pretty big class. There was 200 students, and I had to organize a whole schedule, mm-hmm. and pair people up as debate partners. And there are all these factors to take into account, like people's schedules and whether they were on a sports team and what their interests were. And so I collected some information from everyone with a Google form and then wrote up some code to do all the matching for myself. So
oh, wow.
I didn't have to do it by hand.
That's amazing. I love that. And did people view you sort of like a computer guru, or because you were in this computer AP class, it was just sort of par for the course? Like, oh, of course that people would be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it was definitely seeing a little more par for the course. And honestly, even in high school, I felt like I was behind the curve in terms of computer science skill. And that was just purely a function of my location. Sure. There are other students who are like building out apps and thinking about like companies or larger projects to work on. And so I always felt like I was a little behind with my little projects.
Yeah, the Bay Area is like that when it comes to tech. You think that, oh, I'm way low, but then you get slightly out of the Bay Area and you realize, wow, you're highly skilled.
Yeah, exactly. I always imagine if my family continued living in New York, I don't think I would have entered computer science at all. Just because of the level of exposure. So it always, I don't know, for me, I think that having resources available to high school students for computer science is so critical for bringing people into the field.
Sure.
It's very much not surprising to me that there are representation issues for all sorts of diversity in tech.
Yes. And we're going to get to that. But let's fast forward. So you decide when you go to higher education, do you pursue computers right away or do you take a circuitous route to what you do?
I think I was a pretty straight shot case. Okay. I did go into college knowing I had this interest.
This is, once again, it
comes down to the pipeline problem and why I think there's not a great diversity in our field. It's because often once you get to college, you have to be pretty dead set on studying computer science in order to make it happen. And I can't speak for all college experiences, but at least where I was at, you had to take some like difficult courses as a freshman to get into the computer science major. Mm-hmm. And those courses are really difficult for people who are only being exposed to computer science for the first time. And the school was trying to fix this problem by, and they did, they added some new courses that were truly introductory level to help new students ramp up to those courses needed to declare the major. But that was still like still in the process of happening while I was in school. So it was, I had friends who hadn't been exposed to computer science in high school just because they were high schools without as many resources in tech as my school.
Sure.
And it just ended up being like there wasn't enough support for them to find their way through that system. So,
when you were, like, at what point did you have that awareness that there were huge disparities? Did it come when you were talking to your friends, or did it come much later, or did it come when you actually moved out to the Bay Area? When did it suddenly dawn on you that, oh, that these barriers exist, and I'm just fortunate that I didn't have that barrier?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's always an ongoing process of realization, especially for people who are like in places of privilege to like always keep an eye on that and be realizing that again and again. But the first time I remember realizing this and feeling this way was, as you said, when I moved over to the West Coast and just saw that there's a full, like a totally different environment where I was. And Even in the Bay Area, there is a like huge scale of like levels of opportunity that like students in high school have when it comes to learning about the tech. So,
Okay, all right. So now you explain to our listening audience what you are focusing on right now.
So I've been thinking about how to make language models, things like ChatGPT, more reliable for users who are trying to learn new information mm-hmm. from them. That's the very high level goal.
Okay.
I think there.
Go on.
I was going to say, I think there's a lot of industry excitement about what these models can do. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of focus on their potential, but I'm trying to think more about what are they capable of doing now, mm-hmm. and how can we make sure that's a reliable experience and an informative experience for like end users, mm-hmm. like me and you.
Okay, so with regards to the language models in ChatGPT, we've all seen the news articles about like people using artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, OpenAI, whatever, to do their work. For example, attorneys who are using it and it's citing mm. imaginary cases.
Yeah.
How does that happen? That it's giving information mm-hmm. that is just patently fabricated
mm-hmm.
and representing it yes. as true.
Yes. Okay, great question. So this kind of goes back to what even is a language model in the first place.
Okay.
So a language model, I'll say it in the first pass as a reiteration of its name, it's trying to model the distribution over words in our language. So in the training phase, these models are exposed to gigabytes and gigabytes of text. Mm-hmm. And the model is trying to learn to predict the next word in a passage of text,
okay.
given all of the preceding words.
Okay, so it's almost like an improv.
Sorry, can you repeat that once more?
It's almost like an improv. There's some things where, like, someone will say a word, and then the next person has to, like, you're making sentences, yes. but you don't know what the next word is coming until
yes.
it comes to you.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison. I like that explanation a lot. yeah, it's a great analogy. Yeah, it's a little bit like improv. It's not explicitly grounded to any like objective truth.
Okay.
Instead, it's truly just a probability distribution over the next word in your sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally, if you look at the model internals, the generation process is literally sampling the next word in the sequence.
What does that mean?
And then, that means, let's say that we have a sentence. Let me think. If we have a sentence like, thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that we're partially through generating a sentence like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're up to the fourth word. So we have thank you for having.
Mm-hmm.
And now the model is going to put in its prediction for what that fifth word should be.
Okay.
And so it actually has let me think about how to put this in a clear way. But it has a probability distribution over all of the words in our vocabulary
mm-hmm.
for what that fifth word should be.
Okay, whether it's me
so
or us.
So thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Me might have a much higher probability than another word like dog, doesn't make sense.
Okay, yeah, right? yeah.
So each of the words in our language has a probability associated with it. So when it comes to generating that fifth word, we sample mm-hmm. over that probability distribution.
Okay. And so you're interested in developing a way of harnessing that learning model so it gives back better results. But how do mm-hmm. you do that with flawed data? You know, it's like it's pulling it from the internet, and as you know, it's just a free for all out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So data quality is a huge contributing factor to the quality of the model outputs.
Mm-hmm.
And because these large language models are trained on so much data in their initial training phase, mm-hmm. the quality of that data, as you point out, is not very good.
Yep.
It often has a lot of junk in it, like just maybe perhaps symbols that are not always completely intuitive as language.
Mm-hmm.
It may contain misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
It may contain like unpleasant content that's like racist or sexist,
mm-hmm.
Content that we don't want. So there are efforts to refine the training data sets to contain less of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the overall strategy is after the initial training phase with a huge amount of perhaps lower quality data,
mm-hmm.
there are later training stages with smaller data sets of higher quality data.
And who determines what constitutes higher quality data? Is it a computer? Is it a person? Is it an organization?
Yeah, so a mixture of all of those things.
Okay.
So certainly there are some cases where you can filter automatically with an algorithm. But there are other cases where you do want a human identifying what's good data, or perhaps labeling the data themselves,
mm-hmm.
As what's high quality versus not. And in terms of who's doing this labeling, it really depends on who has the resources to do this.
Okay.
And often this falls to these larger companies. And there have been significant open source efforts as well, academic efforts as well.
When you talk about these larger companies, are you talking about for-profit companies? Are you talking about universities? What
mm-hmm.
are you talking about? Because if it's a for-profit company, there is a built-in incentive to make data that leans toward what you wanted to support.
Yeah, yep, I agree. So it's a mixture of companies that are for profit. There's also universities who do this, but yes, definitely the financial incentives can come into play,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps as early as the data set collection and refinement.
Okay.
Yeah, that's definitely something that people are concerned about.
Okay. Well, I want to, okay, so your current work is on large language models. So, okay, describe what it is that you do and what the, I want to know, like, how is it structured? What is it that you're doing? What is the end result that you're going for in your current work?
Okay, yes. So we started talking about how I've been interested in making these language model outputs more reliable.
Yes.
And so we've covered how these language models work. We've covered the types of data at a high level that they're trained on and how problems can creep in through those data sources.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let's get to exactly what I've been trying to work on
mm-hmm.
to make these outputs more reliable.
Okay.
So I've been interested in grounding language model outputs in sources.
Oh, okay.
And ideally, these sources are reliable sources. But for now, let's say we can rely on a search engine to surface websites with content that are more reliable than not.
Okay.
So I am leaving in my work, I have made this assumption that perhaps I have a tool that can provide me with sources that I can trust on as being reliable. And I'm focusing more on the part of how do I ensure that the generation of these language models is grounded in these sources that I have on hand.
Okay. So are these sources that you have on hand, are these ones that you have vetted, or is it a list that comes to you?
Yeah, I have been running experiments on corpuses like Wikipedia.
Okay.
And literally using search engine APIs to grab like the top 10 results. So it's not like the sources I'm actually using, they're not completely reliable, right? They're just sources
sure.
from the internet.
Okay.
But the focus of my work, like there's a whole area of fact checking and trying to identify which sources are actually reliable.
Okay.
Which is a very difficult problem and has been around since before all of this machine learning and AI work. And I am not quite focused on that direction.
Okay.
But yes, it is a very important component at the end of the day.
Okay. So when you take these language models, then how do you deploy them so that, like, how do you get them to be reliable, and how do you fine tune them? So, because we've talked about the higher level, and then we've talked about mm-hmm. a subset of reliability, and then where do you go mm-hmm. from there?
Okay, so I'm going to start with the more general approaches of what people do first, and then I'll move on to talking about what I've specifically been doing in my experiments.
Okay.
But there are a handful of approaches here that people have been using to refine language models after their initial training stage.
Okay.
And one term that has been floating around a lot is this notion of fine-tuning. I think there's a lot of jargon in this field. Maybe all fields are like this, but I'll mention a couple of them that I think come up a lot. But fine-tuning is literally just continued training, but on a smaller, higher-quality data set.
Okay.
And even within fine-tuning, there are, like, a couple of variants of it. So one popular technique right now is called reinforcement learning from human feedback, or abbreviated to RLHF. And this is a special type of data set where you elicit, well, you provide a human judge mm-hmm. with two versions of an output
okay.
for the same question. And you ask this human judge, which output do you prefer?
Okay.
And so you collect this preference data across many, many different inputs and output pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you set up a fine-tuning scheme using reinforcement learning to get the model to provide outputs that are more agreeable to the human users.
Okay.
So
go on.
This so that's one type of fine-tuning that's very common.
Mm-hmm.
Another type of fine-tuning that's very common right now is called instruction fine-tuning. And this just means that the data set that's been being used for fine-tuning, it contains inputs that are asking the model to follow a particular instruction. Like, it could be something like summarize the following passage.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be something like write a poem in the style of Shakespeare about pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the corresponding response that would be appropriate for that instruction. Those instruction-following data sets are also used to fine-tune these language models to encourage more instruction-following behavior in the language models themselves.
Okay.
So this is all to say models like ChatGPT
mm-hmm.
That are more of a chatbot interface have been fine-tuned to have that conversational quality
mm-hmm.
And definitely RLHF was used, for instance, for ChatGPT.
Okay. So when we talk about the second one, like you mentioned William Shakespeare writing about pancakes or anything like that.
Yeah.
Which I, uh-huh. Now you made me want pancakes, but that's another issue. so you'll have people who have their works that are on that are online. How do you avoid the plagiarism aspect? The people are saying, you know, I have this intellectual property, and you're copying. Like, uh-huh. how do you mitigate that?
Yeah, that is a huge issue, and really affects people's livelihoods.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that is a big concern, and we've seen legal action over this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like the New York Times right now has a lawsuit against OpenAI over issues like this.
Okay.
In order of how to deal with it, I haven't worked on this problem specifically, but I'm sure that one approach people use is to employ fine-tuning approaches to mm-hmm. discourage the exact copying of content.
Mm-hmm.
But another approach, I guess, like, it is related to my work. I just haven't worked on this side of it too much.
Sure.
But, and this is going to be a kind of a segue also into what I've been working on specifically for reliability.
Mm-hmm.
It's to provide citations from the model outputs to the sources.
There we go.
That were either used to construct them or perhaps just contain similar information to the outputs.
And I have, to me, citations are like the easiest way to avoid problems and beefs with people. It's like, I don't understand why people can't just cite everything. You know what I mean? It's like, you want to avoid a lawsuit, just say where you got the information. You want to avoid accusations of plagiarism, just say, put citations, and then they go, oh, okay, got it, no problem. What is it about citing things?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you probably don't know, but I don't know what it is about simply citing uh-huh. something that people have such an objection to.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a great question. I think it really is just the fact it's a little extra work.
Yeah, but it's a lot less. You mean it's a little extra work up front, but you know it avoids a lawsuit.
Yeah, I agree. It avoids a lawsuit. It makes your information content more reliable,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, given that your sources are reliable.
Yes.
It increases your credibility. I mean, there's a broad range of benefits. So I agree. It's a little mysterious why it's not more common. But I think from a technical standpoint, it is difficult to get working reliably,
mm-hmm.
at least for language model outputs.
So
I think it's been very
go ahead.
I think it's been very exciting to see there are some deployed systems, language model systems, that have flavors of citation Ooh. Present.
Like?
So, for instance, Google Bard, which was recently renamed to Gemini.
Okay.
Is an interface of a language model and a search engine together.
Okay.
And here you can type in your question or your query, and you get an output from Gemini, and you can hit there's a little Google symbol right now on their website that you can click, and it will highlight different portions of the output
mm-hmm.
and link the corresponding source.
Oh, okay. That seems reasonable.
So that's pretty cool. I think the tricky part is, so there are some other systems like this as well, like Bing Chat has a similar feature. And people are very much trying to work on developing more systems like this.
Mm-hmm.
But the attributions themselves are not 100% reliable. So it's very important, if you're using one of these deployed systems,
mm-hmm.
To still double check the cited sources to see if it actually is making the same claim that it's attributing.
Oh, like if it says something like, it's just something outrageous, and it's like, and then it goes Abraham Lincoln. You need to, or are you saying it's the actual link itself, and you travel back, and it's like, oh, it doesn't say that at all.
Can you explain the first case a little bit more?
Well, for example, you'll see things attributed, like you'll see quotes that clearly were not made by that person. They'll say, like, Albert Einstein says, people be tripping. And, you know that Albert Einstein never said that. But you might find a site that says that, you know, that attributes this quote to Albert Einstein. So are you saying that type of quote? Or are you saying it's more that you follow the citation and they didn't make that claim at all? Or is it both?
I'm sure both are present. From what I've observed, it's more of the latter category. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, yeah, there are many sources on the internet that aren't reliable.
Right.
And it's sometimes hard to distinguish between those and the reliable ones. So, yeah, I think that both of those errors are likely present in these systems.
Okay. In your work, what's your favorite thing that you're doing right now? What's the thing that, you know, every time you do it, you go, oh, yay, this is why I got into this?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm just going to latch onto the most recent thing that made me feel this way,
mm-hmm.
which was I got to do some like engineering work in the last week, which, I don't know, for me at least, research kind of alternates between an ideation phase where I'm reading a lot of papers and trying to come up with my own mental model of things,
mm-hmm.
and the engineering stage where I have some experiment I want to run, and then I have to do the engineering work to get it working. And I think that transition from having some idea to getting to do the engineering work and then starting to see things come together is really, really fun. I think it goes back to that feeling of being empowered
mm-hmm.
That I mentioned at the beginning of the interview when I was first starting to code these little tools to help myself in day to day. I think it's always very pleasing to me to be able to have an idea and sit down at my computer and code up something that makes my life easier.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, like, will let me find out new things or test new systems.
So when you're out in the field and you run across youngsters, you know, people still in elementary school, how do you explain to them what it is that you do? In a way that is, you know, like a 10-year-old, like, you know, saying, hey, what do you do? How do you explain it to them so that they go, oh, I get it?
Oh, that's such a good question. Okay, I'm really sad because I don't have, like, any younger cousins or anyone like that to talk to more about these things.
Uh-huh.
But I did at some point get to work with an elementary school class and develop like a little curriculum for like introduction to computer science and like the machine learning side of things. And there, I think it's really fun to, I guess now that I'm working on language models, I'll probably, we could like literally go and look at ChatGPT together and like have them ask questions and look at the outputs and then question, like, okay, are these outputs actually something we can trust? And have that sort of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's nice because it's very accessible for people right now. And it's probably, honestly, a tool that younger students will come into contact with, even in their, like, education journey.
Mm-hmm.
But at least for the elementary school class I was working with, I was explaining this concept of decision trees, which is when you're trying to make some sort of classification, you branch off to the left if, like maybe I'm trying to decide if I should make pancakes or eggs this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay,
to go back to the breakfast content.
Uh-huh.
And maybe if I know I'm not going to have a lot of time this morning, maybe eggs are faster than pancakes. So mm-hmm. if I have less than 30 minutes, I'm going to decide to cook eggs. And if I have more than 30 minutes, I'm going to decide to cook pancakes. But sometimes these decision trees get more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I mean, that's a type of machine learning model. And it's so accessible to students, even in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something about, like, my work in machine learning that gets me excited. It starts sometimes from very simple concepts and can build up to these very powerful models.
Well, with that in mind, I know there are a lot of people who are still being exposed to computers for the first time. And since you've taught a class, what would you recommend for a kid to kind of understand what you're talking about? Some sort of reading or maybe a YouTube video or an audiobook? What do you recommend as an intro?
Oh, okay, another great question. I really am a fan of Khan Academy. And if I remember correctly, they have content for learning how to code in Python.
Mm-hmm.
And once someone, I think, begins to, like, I think my advice high level is to just try to engage, try to start building, download Python. I know the download can be difficult and a little time intensive, but I think there's a lot of resources online to help you sort through how to move through it. And it also in and of itself is a learning process of how to get comfortable with messing around with the computer and making mistakes, but eventually seeing that you can figure it out. But just develop that confidence in starting to code. And then in terms of the machine learning side, once you feel or start feeling comfortable with Python, there's a lot of online resources and libraries associated with the Python language to start playing around with things. But find some question or problem you have in your life that you think is tedious to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe, yeah, try like coding up a tool to help you with it. But yeah, just getting involved like that, I think, is the best way.
Okay. Well, with that, Teddy Wuerlich, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Wonderfest for being on the show today and talking about, and if people want to find out more about your research, where can they find it online?
Oh, I have a personal website, but I don't know the URL right now. You can search me up. My name is Theodora Wuerlich.
Mm-hmm. And they can just look that way?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way.
Okay. Well,
thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you, Theodora Teddy Wuerlich. All right, people of Earth, you have it there. There's learning, and you can look it up and do all kinds of fun stuff. If you've got a 10-year-old, have them download Python.
It's your hand to compute. It's more than to compute. We'll be right back.
That's Kraftwerk. It's more fun to compute. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, you know, Brava Theater Center is always putting on good stuff, and you know how we like music and whatnot. So we're combining the two by having a person from the Brava Theater Center who's going to be doing a release there. I'd like to welcome Miklit Hadero. Hello.
Hello, hello. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So tell me, our listening audience may not be familiar with you, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Of course. So I am an Ikkyo jazz singer-songwriter, vocalist, composer. I was born in Ethiopia and grew up all over the States and have been in the Bay Area for coming on my 20th anniversary. Yes, indeed. And I make music that is inspired by the places that I have called home. I bring Ethiopian traditional rhythms and melodies and scales together with jazz and a singer-songwriter's strum. That is the music I've been making for a long time now. I love this community. I love KPOO and listen regularly. And I'm super excited to have a new EP coming out this week called Ethio Blue, and we'll be celebrating the release of that EP at the Brava Theater on Saturday night, the 9th.
That's awesome. So I have a lot of questions. I'm going to preface it with a lot of people think Africa is a country as opposed to a continent with lots of other countries in it that have their own unique traditions and musical styling. So how would you characterize the Ethiopian style of music versus any others? And when you came here, did you see any Ethiopian influences in any of the contemporary music that we were already listening to here?
Well, I will answer your second question first.
Okay.
Because I had the pleasure of meeting Stevie Wonder once, a dear friend of mine, another Ethiopian singer, Weino Wondosin, was his backing vocalist for a long time. Went to a show, got to meet Stevie afterwards, and I was like, okay, Stevie, now you go ahead and tell me, Sir Duke, those pentatonic scales that you got going on in Sir Duke, now you must have been listening to Ethiopian music when you wrote those, right? And he just laughed. But that, for example, there's a lot of Stevie Wonder from the late 70s and the early 80s that has a lot of pentatonic scales that are very reminiscent of a lot of Ethiopian music. And one thing I want to say about Ethiopian music is that even within the country, there's an incredible diversity of sounds and styles. Like in Ethiopia, there's over 80 languages and 300 dialects and as many musical traditions. So, you know, I'm really influenced by Ethiopian jazz. Ethiopian jazz, known as Ethio jazz, was created in the late 60s and 70s. The godfather of Ethio jazz is a gentleman by the name of Mulatu Asatke. Many people know his music from the series called Ethio Peaks that released a lot of Ethio jazz, and it's actually still going. And Mulatu Asatke is one of my inspirations. He's one of my mentors, in fact. And I had the pleasure of meeting him in Ethiopia many times. And one day he sat me down and said, you know, you need to find your contribution to Ethio jazz and keep innovating, the music. So I see myself as being on a continuum of Ethio jazz. I use the pentatonic scales. You know, there's pentatonic scales, that's five notes. There's many different kinds. Pentatonic scales are found across the African continent. And in blues, you know, blues music is based on a pentatonic scale, obviously. Also in African music from the Americas, via African peoples in the Americas. And so, like, for me, Ethio jazz is really about bringing Ethiopian pentatonic scales into relation with jazz music, into conversation with jazz music. The scale, the rhythms are often 6-8 rhythms, 3/2, 6/8. They make you want to dance. Ethiopian, there are so many different Ethiopian dances. One of my favorites is the skastal, which is the shoulder dance. And so these kinds of rhythms make you want to move your shoulders. It's like the rhythm tells your body what to do, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And it's really joyful music. It's music that has a space for also like claiming a space for African immigrant experiences and cultures, cultural power, but in a way that is relational and interrelational.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to like a super basic. I don't have any musical training, so I don't know what a pentatonic scale is. I know penta means five.
Five notes.
But
five
like,
notes. It means five notes.
So you were saying that Sir Duke has a pentatonic scale. Is it those? Is it the horns at the beginning, or where does that happen?
Da 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 da.
So that's
it's all. Go ahead.
No. So that's the part that's pentatonic. Like you recognized it immediately, and you were like, "Oh, that's home stuff."
Yes, absolutely. And even when I play it for like my aunties who had never heard Stevie Wonder, mm-hmm. they were like, "Oh, there we are."
Okay.
In conversation with each other. You know what I mean?
Okay. Have you heard that? Like, can you give other specific examples in popular music where the pentatonic scale exists?
Well, you mean in the way that it exists in Ethiopian music?
Yes.
In popular music?
Yes.
I don't actually know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know where else it exists in popular music in a way that I can name, except for like, you know, when there's many places where like people will use Ethiopian music, like there's a famous Ethiopian composer by the name of Mahoy, mm-hmm. Gemariam Gebru, and she's all over like a million commercials and, you know, movies on Netflix and everything.
Okay.
Ethio jazz had a kind of national resurgence after Jim Jarmusch, the
filmmaker.
The movie director mm-hmm. put a lot of Mulat Astatke's music in a 2005 film called Broken Flowers.
Okay.
So that sort of started a renaissance of Ethiopian music. So
when did you decide to become a musician, and was your family on board with it?
I started my music career in the Bay Area mm-hmm. when I moved here.
Okay.
You know, growing up, I always wanted to be a singer, but didn't really understand how one goes about doing that. And then when I came to the Bay, I just got swept up in communities of musicians who were making work that was relevant to the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
I also started organizing. I've been involved in projects, initiatives, and organizations that, you know, that work at the intersection of arts and culture and social justice for many years in the Bay Area also taught me that. So when I moved here and I saw that kind of ethos, I was like, oh, that's how I can do it.
Ah.
And I, you know, started from there. And once I did that, every step I took towards music took 10 steps towards me. And,
aww.
You know, my parents at the beginning were like, wait, what? No way, no. But, They were like, I know.
That's why I asked.
They were like, you can't be we came here as refugees and you're going to choose uncertainty. No.
Right.
but they have become my greatest supporters. Mm-hmm. And, my dad is coming to the Brava Theater for our performance on Saturday night. And let me tell you about my dad. Like, people will come to my show. Mm-hmm. And then 10 years later, come to another one, and they'll be like, I met your dad. And he's such a dynamic, bright, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Soul. He stands next to the CD station and just, like, shakes everyone's hand who buys merch. And, mm-hmm. you know, the whole 2 rows ahead of him and 2 rows behind him will know that that's his daughter on stage. So he has become my biggest supporter. My parents are my biggest supporters, but it certainly took a while.
Oh, know? I'm sure. I'm sure. Your story reminds me, because Margaret Cho, her mom comes to everything, or came to everything, and it was the same thing where it's like, that's my daughter. So I love that they make that turn, or like they see how happy and how fulfilled you are, and then they're 100% on board.
Yeah, and that it's working, like, because before it's like, wait, how's this going to work?
Yeah.
And then it goes from an abstraction to like a concrete reality. And
right.
then we're not having conversations about what if, we're having conversations about what is, you know?
Yes, yes. And speaking of what is, it's called Ethio Blue, and it's at the Brava Theater this Saturday. So tell me, what's going to happen, and at what time does it start, and what can we expect?
Well, I'm super excited to have the Locura Trio opening the show, and then we will have my full ensemble. There are six of us. We have toured all over the world. I've brought my band to Ethiopia, all over Europe, all over the U.S. The show starts at 8:00, and we will rock it for the people.
Nice, nice, nice. And how did you get involved with the Brava crowd?
Oh, I've been, okay, I did my first show at Brava maybe in 2009, so it's been a lot of years.
Okay.
But it's been a long time since I've performed there. But I love what they do. I love Brava, the women in the arts is their underlying mission. And, Friday is International Women's Day. So I loved the idea, the actual release date of the record itself, the album, it's Friday, and the show is on Saturday. But, being so close to International Women's Day, this being Women's Month, I thought it would be such a wonderful collaboration to be releasing together with an organization that was really thinking about the collective power of women, women's stories, women's songwriting practices, women's creativity, and celebrating with that organization for the release of this.
Very cool. So, where can people get tickets? One, can people walk up and buy tickets if they can't get them in advance? Two, and where can, when will people be able to find your CD? Three.
The CD will be out everywhere on Friday, on streaming platforms.
Oh, okay.
If you want to get a physical copy, got to come to the show on Saturday.
Okay.
You can get tickets at brava.org, or you can come to the door, but I do recommend getting tickets in advance.
And if people want to find out more about you and your tours and what you're up to, do you have an online presence?
Absolutely. All my social media handles are Meklit Music, M-E-K-L-I-T Music. And that is also my website, meklitmusic.com. And even if you forget my name, if you're like, what was that Ethiopian sister talking about on the air? You can, even if you just look up Ethiopian singer San Francisco, I come right up.
Very nice, very nice. Well, Meklit Hadero, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Marilyn. Thank you for having me.
All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go hear some good, good music over at Brava Theater Center. And here's a little sample of what McLeet's going to do. It's called Antidote. Oh, and I'm going to be taking off. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and tiddly-doo.
Every day heartbreak, every day love, every day kindness, remember your mother. Every day pressure, every day pain, everyone's striving to find home again. Antidote, 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 take the power from the poison, remind them of what is inside them.